Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team.
And welcome aboard, everyone. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder, for those that are joining us live, please join the chat room. You can get there from the bottom of the show page, and you'll be up there with the usual suspects. And that's kind of our preferred method. If you have some questions for our host, or you would like to offer up a question of your own building off a previous conversation, please fold it into the chat room. Eagle One will be there. He'll grab those ideas and fold them right in for us. And if you're new to Mid-Rats, or if you've missed a few episodes in the past, remember, over at Blog Talk Radio, you have the entire archive. Or if you're lazy like me, you can just set yourself up to get the podcast on iTunes, and every time you sync, it'll load right in for you. Now, on with the show. This week, we're going to build off of a conversation we had last week about counterinsurgency. We're going to do that for the first half hour. In the second half hour, we are going to bring on the surface warfare reporter for Navy Times, Phil Ewing, and we're going to talk about some of the more important issues that have come up over the last few months about our Navy. Our first guest is Dr. Mark A. Genest. He holds the Forrest Sherman Chair of Public Diplomacy and Strategy and the Policy Department Center for Irregular Warfare and Child Care.
Sorry about that.
In 2009, Dr. Genest received the Commander's Award for Civilian Service from the Department of Army for outstanding service as a special advisor to the commander of Task Force Mountain Warrior Station Regional Command of Afghanistan. He earned his PhD from Georgetown University in International Politics, but before coming to the Naval War College, he taught at Georgetown University as well, the U.S. Air War College, and the University of Rhode Island. In addition, Dr. Genest worked on Capitol Hill for both Senator John Chafee and Representative Claudine Schneider. In addition to numerous articles on international relations theory, strategic communications, American foreign policy, and public opinion, he has written a few books, including Negotiating the Public Eye, The Impact of the Press on the Intermediate Range Nuclear Force. We also have Negotiating Conflicts and Cooperation, Evolving Theories of International Relations, and also STAND, Contending Ideas and Opinions in World Politics. If you'd like to see a little more detail in those books, you can find links to them at my home blog. Mark, welcome to Mid-Rats.
Always a pleasure, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Just kind of coming off the road there, and we talked a little bit before the show started, and it's in the little bio that I briefed. You do have some recent experience in Afghanistan, and I wonder, when we talk about counterinsurgency, there is a lot of competing theories on how you successfully do it or don't successfully do it and how you tailor it for each particular operation. And there's especially been a lot of discussions about a McKiernan policy, a McChrystal policy, an Obama policy, a Petraeus policy. But there's actually a good continuum. And from your perspective, could you briefly update our listeners on how that continuum has gone with what we're doing in Afghanistan, or AFPAC, if you will, from General McKiernan's shape, clear, hold, build, and the comprehensive approach to what we're seeing right now as General Petraeus starts to put his fingers on it at the tactical in-theater operational level?
Wow, that's going to take a long time. let me quarrel with the assumption. The assumption is that there's been a rational plan put in place for the last 5 years. And I'm not saying that to demean anyone. What I'm saying here is that there have been competing ideas on how to implement counterinsurgency strategy and whether or not to implement counterinsurgency strategy versus counterterrorism strategy. And it's gone back and forth over the last half dozen years at least in Afghanistan. The current approach, how that differs from the previous approach, is still yet to be seen. It was McChrystal that really began to try to implement in a more forceful fashion the Petraeus idea of a focus on the population, of the clear whole build, and to secure the population first and foremost in order to forestall the insurgents. You know, as Mao said, the insurgents are swim amongst the people. They're the fish in the sea and the sea of the people. And the whole point was to separate the insurgents from the population. And the way you do that is to, A, secure the population, and, B, convince the population that the insurgents don't have anything to offer them while the government has much to offer them. So that's essentially a summary of what Petraeus said and what McChrystal began to try to implement. The problem that I saw when I was in Afghanistan was the theory and practice discontinuity. The theory of insurgency is a very labor-intensive strategy. You have to get your people out patrolling like we did in Afghanistan, like we did in Iraq. You have to get MRAP patrols. You have to get, you know, police on the beat. You have to get U.S. military and ISAF forces out in the streets on a daily basis, patrolling with their Afghan counterparts. And that's where I think we fell, short of the ideal. Because we weren't either willing or able to produce the kind of labor-intensive resources that were necessary in order to implement a full-blown counterinsurgency strategy.
Eagle One?
I guess that your focus is on the strategic communication aspect of this, and I've seen someone who, one of your students apparently, a guy named Mr. Robert Perry, quote you as suggesting that a lot of these points have to do with marketing or and spinning our message to the population we're trying to influence. Could you go into that as that relates to COIN?
Sure. The warfare, as Clausewitz tells us, you know, war can never for a moment be separated from politics, right? It's the use of violence to compel your enemy to do your will, and your will is to achieve certain political ends. So war can never be separated from a political process. The problem with contemporary American counterinsurgency strategy is that we try to separate it from politics, and that's what makes it difficult. The whole point of counterinsurgency strategy is to win the political contest with the enemy. So you're essentially running a political campaign, and I cut my teeth. I was working on political campaigns from age 9 and 10 throughout, working on both the state, local, congressional, senatorial, gubernatorial, and presidential levels. So that's how my introduction to politics was always through the political campaign process. And that's the way I view both information operations and strategic communications. You have a political goal, and that political goal has to be marketed in a way that the people, A, understand the goals, and B, the goals resonate with the people. And if you're not doing that, then you're going to lose the battle. Because if anything in the study of warfare teaches us anything, it's regardless of capability, the side that has the greater political will, the side that adapts better, and the side that understands the political elements of warfare better is the side that wins. That's how the weak defeat the strong. If you're looking at strategic communications, then, as the main emphasis on warfare, particularly in insurgency, that strategic communications, the political battle is number one. And the military aspect, the kinetic, the violent aspects of warfare always have to be subjugated to the greater political goals and the greater political strategy. That's what I meant when my student said it's about spin. It's not about just about spin. It's about putting the political elements first and knowing that violence is simply one tool that you have to choose from in order to achieve your political end.
When we look at the challenge in Afghanistan, we look at the tribal challenge of working with those tribes, and that's the external tribes. But I think if you look internally to us being the coalition that's fighting there, we also have some tribal issues, and it ties into the politics you were just talking about. When you look at the maneuver forces that we've had with us in Afghanistan that operate relatively caveat-free, and that's mostly in the south and the east, you're looking at the major forces have been the Dutch, the Canadians, the British. You also have a few minor forces. The Danes and the Estonians have done a great job fighting relatively caveat-free. But what we've seen earlier this summer, the Dutch government fell, an election came up over the question in Afghanistan. The Dutch are going to be leaving Erzgan coming up in August. The Canadians are planning to follow next year. And, of course, the new British prime minister has had a fair bit of press time about their desire. I've read both 2014, 2015. It doesn't matter, really, which year it is. But from a STRATCOM perspective, if you have what we've seen over the last 18 months, lack of a better phrase, a surge of U.S. forces, but we also see our best allies already planning to go home, have we really grasped from a STRATCOM in Afghanistan and outside how to tell that story in one way that doesn't hurt us, or are we still not fully grasping it? Because especially in the U.S. press, I don't see that much discussion of it.
Well, you know, you're getting something that I think is a critical component. The commander-in-chief has said that the United States will begin withdrawing troops within the next 12 months. So when we point to our European allies and say, well, they're planning on pulling out troops, you have to also take into consideration that even as the surge continues, we have capped the surge at a certain number and then said we were going to be withdrawing troops after a certain amount of time. So it's not a strategic communications problem here. It is a strategy and policy problem that we're having. You know, that's the key component. In my view, and again, my views do not represent the Naval War College or the Department of Defense, they're simply my own, in my view, you have severely weakened your ability to achieve your political ends when you tell your enemy, I am going to be here for 12 months, and then I'm going to begin withdrawing. You have literally given the advantage to your enemy, because now your enemy knows all they have to do is outlast you. So there are some things that go beyond strategic communications and information operations to fundamental strategy, and in this case, even a policy decision, that undermine your ability to achieve your ends.
Eagle One.
Well, I'm not an expert in strategic communication by any stretch of the imagination, but if you tell people you're leaving, I mean, that seems to be the most ineffective strategic communication you could make, go ahead, huh?
Well, you know, that was my point. Now, look, I mean, let's be fair to the administration. The administration has said it was going to do this because it believed that it would put pressure on the Afghanistan government to finally get serious about training up their police force, training up the Afghan National Army, and making the critical, difficult political decisions necessary in order to begin forming a more efficient and effective government. So, you know, that's the counterargument to my point. But my point is a larger point in that the message you're sending to your allies as well as to the enemy is one that you do not have the will to sustain this conflict as long as it takes. That automatically gives your enemy an advantage over you.
Yeah, let me go back to that Perry thing already. He, in a footnote, says that you identified five seams or weaknesses in the United States government and its coalitions, and among those were the moral justification of Muslim self-defense, the protracted war strategy to wear down the U.S., and coalition support, a strategy to split the coalition alliance by attacking the weak links in the coalition, an economic attrition strategy of draining U.S. resources and attacking the will of the U.S. public and those of the coalition. I mean, I see all of those at play when one of the campaign strategies of a political campaign is to say we're gonna leave on X date rather than we're gonna see this thing through to the end. But would you elaborate more on those five points?
Well, I mean, again, how do the weak defeat the strong? They outlast them. The weak defeat the strong when they have a greater will. and using a combination of traditional insurgency strategies coupled with terrorism, they've actually selected an extraordinarily cost-effective manner in which to carry out a protracted war. All right, so they are doing exactly what me, as a political strategist and as a military strategist, more importantly, would have them do. They're doing exactly what they should be doing. And that is, again, hit and run, guerrilla warfare tactics, intimidation of the population, and coupled with some effective information operations on their part. You know, when we inoculate children that come in and say, we're simply, making them all infertile. I mean, so what happens is they take a program that the United States government and ISAF forces have put into place that's extraordinarily effective, very good on the bald-faced facts of it, and yet with a simple disinformation campaign, they've already intimidated the population. I mean, that's just one beautiful example, and I don't mean that in a positive sense, but in a strategic sense, a very effective example of what the enemy can do to undercut costly programs that on the face of it seem like a perfect program. The other aspect of this is, of course, terrorism is not just cost-effective. It is cost-effective in that it creates a disproportionate amount of damage to how cheap it actually is to carry out. So, for example, 9/11, Bin Laden used to brag all the time, it cost about $250,000 to carry out the 9/11 tragedy. And yet it cost the American economy over $1 trillion. If that's not cost-effective, I don't know what is. So these are the kinds of methods that al-Qaeda and then an Afghan regional level, this is what the Taliban does too in terms of carrying out civilian casualties. Their whole point is to terrorize the population, to intimidate the population so that it doesn't go over and act constructively with the government. And then those elements that they can recruit, they do so because there are legitimate grievances that all Afghans have against their government. And the problem with getting involved in countries that are economic basket cases that really aren't countries in the Western sense, and we should have known this from the outset, is that there are always a multitude of legitimate grievances against the government. And if you're looking at this the way I look at it as a political campaign, and if you look at the Taliban, ironically, as the challenger and the government of Afghanistan being the incumbent, in a political campaign, when I'm running a campaign and I'm running for the challenger, I'm working for the challenger, all the challenger has to do is say, do you like the way things are? Are things going well for you? Well, if you don't like the way things are going, then you vote for me. And the Afghan people, enough of them anyway, are going over to the Taliban because the Taliban is giving them an alternative to the corruption and ineffective government of Afghanistan. And the great thing about being a challenger is all you have to do is throw a couple of platitudes out. You know, change is good. The American, read my lips, no new taxes kind of thing. Every candidate in American history has done that as a challenger. They're broad pep that people say, well, look, I'm not quite sure what the challenger is all about, but I know that the incumbent's not doing a good job. That's exactly what the Taliban and al-Qaeda are doing in Afghanistan.
When you look over the last decade,
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Sorry, is the volume a little better now?
No, you're really faded.
Okay, let me try this. How's this going?
Oh, there you are. Much better.
Okay, good. When you look over the last decade, if you're trying to find a successful example of counterinsurgency, I know these two examples, you can almost call them a civil war, but they really were insurgencies. I look at the success in Sri Lanka and also in Colombia against their internal insurgencies. What would you see as the foundation for those two successful counterinsurgency strategies? And is there anything that we could glean that might be useful to us with the challenge that we have right now in the AFPAC area?
Great question. I would actually throw in Peru and their battle against Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path of the 1980s, because they're another good example. All the examples that we've talked about, Peru, Colombia, and Sri Lanka, the big, big difference is that you had an indigenous government fighting for its own life. That meant, in a test of wills, each one of these governments had nowhere to go. Okay, it's not like the United States that can just pull out. You know, the problem in Vietnam, for example, was that the United States could be defeated and the political repercussions would be nominal. U.S. national security would not be affected in a significant fashion. Whereas if the Colombian government accepted defeat, they would literally be out of office and probably dead. So in a test of wills, it's always good to have an indigenous government that understands the consequences. That's number one. Number two, what we can see most from particularly the Peru case and the Colombia case is dynamic political leadership with courage makes a huge difference. It's tremendously important. You know, the Colombian government literally took the chances. You had a charismatic political leader, Uribe, who said, I'm not going to take it anymore. I'm going to put in the reforms I need to. I'm going to risk my personal life, and I'm going to do what's necessary to defeat the FARC. And you had Fujimori in Peru who did the same thing. In fact, Peru had dramatic economic reform, which led to a substantial economic recovery that also undermined the Shining Path. So you have a whole series of things that you can learn. For example, one of the things that we're adopting in Afghanistan now, which it's amazing to me it's taken this long, is the Peru had a strategy called the rondas. And what they did is they went to the local villages and they recruited young men. They trained the young men, and then they recruited men from the villages out in the outskirts where Sendero was powerful. They recruited them from people who are from those villages and then placed them back into the villages and then gave them weapons. They empowered the local villagers to fight the Sendero themselves. This is a key to success for both Colombia and Peru. We've only in the last couple of years begun to do that. And the counterargument to that is, well, you're probably going to arm the people who are going to go over to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban anyway. And there's always that possibility. But one of the things when I was in Afghanistan that I heard most was the frustration of the villagers saying, you come in and you leave, and then at night, Taliban or Al-Qaeda comes in and they kill my cousins or they take people or they intimidate us. Give us the weapons we need to defend ourselves, and then we can take you seriously. It's a high-risk strategy, but it's a risk that at this point is probably worth taking.
Eagle One.
Well, that strategy makes a lot of sense. If you co-opt the villagers to such an extent that they become identified with either the national government or the U.S. or the coalition, they have no choice. You're talking, I think Sun Tzu talks about getting his own force in the place where they had no place to retreat from. Once you get those villagers in position, they either fight or die.
Exactly.
Yeah, that would seem to have an impact on what their view of the world is going to be. And speaking of that, I mean, what you were discussing in the U.S. strategy also struck me as relating to Sun Tzu in that very ground, that there is almost no consequence to us, immediate consequence to us of losing in Afghanistan or withdrawing prematurely, because it's not life or death for us like it is for the villagers there. Would you expand on that a little bit?
Well, you know, that's a very good point. But let me push back on that a little bit. In Vietnam, we could afford to lose Vietnam because Vietnam couldn't reach out and touch us. You know, I mean, the domino effect ended up being to some degree correct because that's exactly what the Soviets were trying to do. But in terms of the direct impact on American national security, homeland security, the effect of losing Vietnam was inconsequential. The difference now is that the enemy can reach out and touch, as they did in 9/11. I mean, so, you know, when the Taliban was harboring al-Qaeda in the aftermath of 9/11, we had no choice but to go in there and take them out. So the consequences are a little higher now. In my opinion, I don't think we can afford to lose Afghanistan. We can afford to have a messy half-victory, but we can't afford defeat, because all that will do is embolden al-Qaeda to launch more attacks, to destabilize more governments. And from a strategic communications point of view, It would be a monumental propaganda victory if the Taliban were able to take power once again in Afghanistan. And it would empower them beyond any measure. And it would be eventually we would have to go back there again.
Well, this is slightly off topic, but I have a question about, speaking of strategic communications, how about the mosque near the 9/11 Ground Zero site in New York City? Isn't that just a classic example of their message getting out?
You know, I think we've much ado about nothing there. You can use that both ways. You can use the fact that we would discuss building a mosque on that area as a tribute to American tolerance, to American principles of religious freedom, to the idea that this was never a war against the Muslim community. It was a war perpetrated against a radical sect that bastardized the Quran more than anything else. So you can look at it as a magnanimous gesture, one that is true to American principles. And actually, I think in many ways it's a very effective communication message that we could be sending to the Muslim community. The counterargument to that is bin Laden can use this and exploit this and can see some measure of victory there. But I think in the long run, it says more good about us than it does anything else.
And Dr. Jeunesse, I think I'll, to end things up, I'll give you a three-hour question, see if we can get an answer after 3 minutes. But there's obviously in Afghanistan, the key and the single point of failure is Pakistan. And there's been a lot of discussion that in the last year, year and a half, Pakistan has made the decision that as opposed to being in its interest to keep Afghanistan weak, that if Afghanistan falls, they endanger themselves. So we have read a lot about how Pakistan is now moving into parts of Pakistan that since the time of the Raj, nobody has really had control over in order to try to take care of the terrorist threat there. How much of that is wishful thinking and how much of that is actual no-kidding progress by the Pakistanis to help in those border areas in Pashtunistan, for lack of a better phrase?
Boy. Very interesting question. You're right. It's a three-hour answer. Let's start with your premise that we cannot solve Afghanistan unless we solve Pakistan. That's absolutely correct. Indeed, the greater danger isn't Afghanistan. It's Pakistan for obvious reasons, because they have nuclear weapons, because they have a much stronger military, because of their geographical position, their geographic position. So Pakistan really is the key here. And this is one of the reasons why I believe we can't afford to be defeated in Afghanistan, because Pakistan is the real crown jewel in that area. Now, in terms of what Pakistan is doing, this is the problem. And this is the problem with alliances in general. When you have allies, allies never share common political goals perfectly. They always have their own particular goals. And with regard to Afghanistan, it is in their interest to keep the United States in Afghanistan. It is in their interest to keep al-Qaeda operating for extended periods of time, because once al-Qaeda is defeated, American military and economic aid evaporates. Because their natural enemy, in their eyes anyway, is India. And India is a natural enemy, ally of the United States. So when if you notice before 9/11, the United States was tipping away from Pakistan substantially and really mending relations with India. India is the world's largest democracy, has a vibrant economy, has more PhDs per capita than any other country in the world, and has what will soon be the largest population in the world. So it's in long-term geopolitical interest of the United States to tip toward India. And Pakistan understands this. So what it does is Pakistan does just enough to keep the United States part of its alliance, but not enough ever to defeat al-Qaeda. And that's the problem we have with this so-called ally.
And that's why this line of work is not easy to do.
Exactly.
Thank you very much for taking time out of your Sunday in spite of the tropical heat that you have up in the Northeast. We really appreciate you coming on MidRats this afternoon.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you very much, and say hi to Senator Kerry's yacht force.
I'm sorry, I don't think he's going to be inviting me very soon.
Thank you, Dr. Janelle.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And as a quick reminder to everybody who's listening live, listening to Navy Mil Blog Radio MidRats, I'm Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, co-host Eagle One from the blog Eagle Speak, and we're both co-bloggers over at the United States Naval Institute blog with a whole bunch of other people. If you haven't visited there recently, go ahead and give it a shot. We're going to roll right back towards a more Navy-centric focus with our second guest. Our second guest is a good friend of the show. He's a returning guest as well, the surface warfare reporter for the Navy Times, Phil Ewing. As a side note, of course, you can catch his work online and also on the Dead Tree publication of Navy Times. But he also keeps a good blog over there, the Scoop Deck, that you can find a link to over at my home blog. I'd invite you to go check it out there, see some of the shorter bits that he puts up that you really won't see in the print publication. And Phil, welcome back to MidRats.
Great to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's middle of the summer, but it's been a pretty busy year for the Navy. And a lot of the work that you've covered here, I think, has gotten a fair bit of momentum because it, lack of a better phrase, it codifies what a lot of people have been expressing concern about there. And a lot of that has to do with the condition of our surface fleet, where we have the second and third order effects of the real small ideas that came up in the last decade. Optimal manning, we're going to do maintenance differently in our ships. And now we're starting to see that. And we saw it on the, I can never pronounce it correctly, the Basel report. The Basel report, however it is. If you could talk for a quick second as a reporter, that was a real fertile ground for you. What were the big things that you pulled away and maybe you found surprising or different in the reaction that you've had to that report?
I think you summed it up really well. It was the kind of thing that codified a lot of things that a lot of people had been saying and observing for the past couple of years in the surface force in particular. And what Admiral Belisle's report did, I've been saying Belisle, I'm not sure if that's right, but that's what we've been saying. What Admiral Belisle's report did was basically put it all into one place. And the phrase I've used, and I'm not trying to upgrade myself by comparison here, but the phrase I've used is that it's the Pentagon Papers about the surface Navy. Because just as was the case back in the Nixon administration, you had kind of a confidential history of the American effort in Vietnam put together. And so although a lot of it was not secret or not technically classified, it was not well known and it was not well understood at the time. And what Admiral Belisle's report has done is basically put together block by block everything the Navy did from the late 90s until today and what some of the consequences were. And, you know, it's a familiar story from other places, but what it comes down to is the Navy was under the gun to crunch down from a large number to a small number of ships. It was under the gun to crunch down from a large number to a small number of people, both of which were expensive. And so it tried all different kinds of policies and philosophies to get there. And depending on the way you look at it, it was successful. The Navy did do a big drawdown. It did save a lot of money. It has, according to the numbers, been able to get a lot more efficiencies. But on the flip side of the coin, the report also found that it couldn't really get the readiness that it used to have. A lot of the crucial systems, including Aegis, the air defense system, are not where they once were. And so it's been a double-edged sword for the surface force and for the Navy as a whole for the past decade or so.
And I think one thing that you've kind of read between the lines and other people have covered it well, especially some of the presence on the that you see out there that know ships real well, is I think from a maintenance and a life cycle point of view, just when the budget crunch and the shipbuilding crunch comes up here in about 10 years, these ships people were hoping to get 30 or more years out of them, there's just simply not going to be able to get that. And I thought another part that really set me back
with the discussions we've had about what really is the crown jewel of our Navy, and we rely on so much. And those are our Aegis-equipped ship. We're talking about traditional air defense, or you're talking about being able to progress on and address a potential anti-ship ballistic missile threat or any type of ballistic missile threat. We've got to have those Aegis ships out there. And there is a lot of, oh my gosh, coming out of these reports about the single points of failure. And how much is this really set in outside of those that really have known this problem for a few years? Or do you think there's another shoe or two to drop on the Aegis story?
I think my view is that there are going to be more shoes to drop on this story. The Navy's official response on Aegis in particular and on the report as a whole has been, well, this kind of confirms what we already knew. You know, they're not telling us anything that we didn't already have a high level of confidence about. But I know that I, as kind of a someone who pays attention to this and a lot of other people who are plugged into it, were surprised at what the Admiral and other reports have found about the readiness of Aegis. Because that is the thing, that is the last thing you would expect for the surface Navy to have trouble with, because it is so important, because it is so critical, and because it's kind of the main nerve of what the surface Navy is about, defending strike groups at sea, doing ballistic missile defense now as a part of the new phase adaptive approach. And so for these documents to indicate that everything is not necessarily squared away on that front, I think was pretty surprising. I'm not sure what will come out next from this, but I know that internally Naval Sea Systems Command and the Naval Surface Forces have been making a lot of recommendations and changes and moving the pieces around to try to get this where they want to be. They're sending BMD ships out with more parts. They're going to try to do the manning a little bit differently and train sailors a little bit better so that they can get their arms around this. But you made an excellent point about how the new trend in the Navy is to keep ships around for as long as possible, to keep cruisers and destroyers in the fleet for as many as 40 years, which is not something the fleet has ever done. I mean, the Navy likes to cut through and chop up its old ships to get new ones. You know, you kind of can't blame them from one perspective, because you always want the newest, greatest thing, but at the same time, they've changed their tune. The problem is, before they came to that decision, they had set into motion these events that had the effect of meaning those ships might not be ready to last that long.
Eagle One.
Well, speaking of shipbuilding, I saw on your on the scoop the other day that Northrop Grumman has decided to get out of the shipbuilding business, and I wonder what your view of that is. Well, what's that hold for us in light of the mess they've made of the new ships they've been producing?
It's a tricky situation, and there's no question about it. I actually am really eager to see what happens on that from every possible permutation, because I'm curious to see what the government does about potentially having some foreign ownership, or at least a portion of foreign ownership for some of the yards that Northrop owns. I'm curious to see what they do down in the Gulf, if they're going to consolidate the yard outside New Orleans and the yard in Pascagoula, Mississippi, and how that will affect all of the dynamics, you know, from the micro level of how many qualified pipe welders you have who can come on a given day and work on a ship, all the way up to what kind of warships does this mean the United States can have over the next 20 years if it's a loss game for one of the biggest defense corporations in the world to say, yeah, you know, we're getting out of this game because we're not making money at it, we're getting beat up in the press, and it's just not worth it anymore. So I don't know. It's going to be a really interesting dynamic going forward to see what happens with that stuff.
We had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, Fred Fry, and we talked about the merchant marine and some of the challenges there. And unfortunately, one question that we didn't get to that kind of ties in with what you're talking about with our shipyards and our industry infrastructure is he mostly talked about from the manning point of view that, hey, our merchant marine is fine and dandy. We have all these great merchant marine academies, and we have people afloat. One thing we don't have is our shipbuilding industry doesn't have much of a presence when it comes to actually building, no kidding, ships, compared to small countries like Denmark, who you know, build these beautiful and nice cruise ships, regular merchant ships, et cetera, and so forth. Outside of just strictly the Navy, doesn't this also further restrict our ability to be able to maintain a presence of just building civilian ships?
It could. And the United States is, I think it's fair to say, kind of lagging the rest of the world when it comes to merchant vessel construction. And I know our current Secretary of the Navy and his predecessor have both flown to South Korea and to Japan and toured shipyards over there as kind of an attempt to say, what are the big Asian yards doing that we can learn from to try to get back in the game, specifically for warships, because that's what he cares about. But I know generally that you know, the shipping industry in this country could potentially be interested in doing more of that stuff domestically. I know that one of the potential outgrowths of Avondale specifically closing or being consolidated would mean that there's a new big potential civilian or merchant shipyard in Avondale for the first time. So it's been a military yard for many years, and it has built LPD-17s most recently, the San Antonio small deck amphibious ships. And it's got the gear, and it's got the cranes, and it's got the workers. And so you could very well be in a situation down there where cruise lines are building their vessels there, or merchant shippers are building their vessels there, if only to keep the yard alive and keep the work done in New Orleans. And that's where it gets into all the longstanding political machinations that go along with everything in the defense industry in this country, but shipbuilding specifically. So that's another one of these kind of X factors that's going to be interesting to watch for the next several years.
Eagle One.
Well, I was also looking at the, you had a nice piece on the FIG 7s. They're going to cannibalize one, I guess, to keep the other ones going, as I recall what you wrote. And you know, why can't we build a FIG 7 type ship and keep them going for a while?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I know there are a lot of people in and out of Washington who say, look, the FIGs are great. You know, they have good endurance. They have a helo deck on the back where you can handle two SH-60 helicopters. You know, they're not your frontline cruisers in terms of air defense, and they don't have, you know, 120 missiles the way a cruiser does, but they're very useful ships. They give the Navy an ability to have a long endurance presence out in the world, down in the Caribbean or out in the Mediterranean if you wanted to, or wherever else. And that whole ability is going to go away when the class gets decommissioned. And the Florida lawmakers right now, I think, are going to try to push for the frigates to stay around for as long as possible. But I also know that the Navy doesn't want to keep them. No matter how useful the ships might have theoretically been at some point, they're old now. They're rusting. Their hulls are have been strengthened because of buckling from slams and everything else. And so it's a question of, it's a theoretically useful ship that is in bad shape, and it's just going to be easier for all concerned if we get rid of them. Well, okay, what does that mean? What takes its place? LCS is supposed to be the kind of pseudo-replacement, although the Navy didn't used to say that LCS was replacing the FIG, although they are much more willing to say that now. They've kind of come around and said, yeah, a lot of these FIG missions are going to go to LCS. The problem is the fleet only has two of them. One of them's in the yard until next month at the earliest, and the fleet isn't really that close to doing the down select they were supposed to do this summer. You know, no one knew when they were actually going to make the decision about which design of LCS would get the next 10 ships, and you know, they don't seem very eager at all to make that announcement. Secretary Mavis, the Secretary of the Navy, has been tapped to do the Gulf Coast recovery work, which I think we would all agree is an important job, and you know, he's got new responsibilities now to the White House. But at the same time, you have to wonder if the LCS down select, which is a big deal for the surface Navy, has kind of been put on the back burner because of that. I mean, I don't know. It's a great question, why we can't build more frigate-style ships, whether it's a national security cutter type ship that would become the National Patrol Frigate, which Northrop pitched a couple of years ago, or some other thing. But I know that the fleet and all the commanders out in the world are going to miss those frigates when they're gone, because we don't really have anything in the works right now that can take their place.
Yeah, Phil, you mentioned something that hey, lucky I was on mute because I started laughing, but it's not a happy laugh. And I know that you remember this as well, that it was just a few years ago that when you said LCS and frigate in the same sentence,
you'd immediately get a vehement response. These are not replacements for the frigates. It's a completely different concept, and people's face would turn red, and they'd be very excited. But now we're kind of hearing that discussion. But when you actually break down capabilities, whether you're talking about endurance or anything else, it's not going to be able to replace the frigates. And because we're kind of painted in the corner of LCS, one of my little pet theories is one reason why we have trouble getting answers is there's a lot of ego that's rolled up in this program and other programs. And as we start to see the second and third order effects of other people's pet programs, whether it was Optimal Manning or a couple of other items out there, transformation and everything that's wrapped up in that, you look at who were the point men on this in the last decade. It was Admirals Clark, Mullen, and Roughhead. It would almost seem to me as if, can't expect it from Mullen. He has higher concerns now. Clark is retired and is waiting for his next contractor gig. But Admiral Roughhead is still there as CNO. I think it would be useful and helpful, not for a mea culpa, and he doesn't need to put on a hair shirt or anything, but to have an honest discussion about some why decisions were made, how they have gone wrong, and steps to correct from the very front. I hate to use the word accountability, but at least consequent management from the front. I really don't see that. Admiral Harvey has made some statements, but he's not the boss man. Do you see any discussion of this, or is this just a subject that's never going to happen because CNOs just don't do such things?
My take on it would be is that this is not something that's going to be addressed in the way that you've described. I know that the Navy has basically come around. If you ask people quietly and you talk with people confidentially, they'll say what we were just saying. LCS is basically going to be a frigate replacement, even though as few as 3 years ago, people were saying, no, that, you know, you're absolutely wrong. They don't have anything to do with each other. These ships are completely different. That's not true anymore. So if there is a reckoning or a coming around to the reality, it's taking place, but it's not going to take place in the way that I think you've described, where CNO will come out and say, look, here's where we are. You know, we need to change some things. Our concept for this is not going to work out as we planned. I think what the Navy has been willing to say is that because LCS, in their phrase, is so flexible and it has all this other modularity about it, that's one of the Pentagon buzzwords, that they can change it into whatever the Navy decides it is, which is, I think, what the other things that the admirals you mentioned would also say. Even today, if you asked them, they would say, well, we built a ship that you can expand in any direction. You could, whatever kind of gear you need to put on it, whatever you need it to do, you can build the stuff and bolt it on and it'll work. That's why they think it's a good idea. It doesn't answer some of the basic qualities that the frigates have, which we were talking about just a moment ago, that long range, the ability to kind of be out there for a long time because of how much fuel the ship needs to run, and because the both designs are optimized to run at high speed, when the frigates usually don't do that. I mean, they cruise along at low speed just to kind of be out there. The other factor here, which is something that I think the Navy both suffers from and benefits from, is that in the pantheon of defense stuff and national defense issues, the Navy is pretty low on the public view totem pole, I would say. And so the fleet has kind of been able to escape the kind of scrutiny that has accompanied the Air Force tanker deal or the F-22 or some of the other things, you know, IEDs, body armor, some of the other things that have kind of captured the public attention, because in the day-to-day shuffle of headlines, the Navy very seldom figures as prominently as the land services do. And so it hasn't had the full force of the public glare that the Army and the Marines had with the IEDs, for example, or the body armor. And this has allowed it to kind of continue at a much more even course than the other services have, but only because there have been congressional hearings and specials on 60 Minutes and everything else, where the Navy doesn't have that same kind of high-level scrutiny. And until it gets that, if it ever does, you know, I think it'll probably stay on pretty much the same course that it's on.
I agree with you 100% about what you said at the end, that the Navy has really been able to get under the radar on a lot of issues that our sister services haven't, and I don't know whether that is really a good thing. Eagle One.
Well, recently the Navy has been in the news. We got a carrier and some other ships off off North Korea, and four SSGNs in the Pacific Ocean. How do we turn that into some visibility with the American public? Do you have any suggestions?
It's an interesting idea. The reason this is fascinating to me, one reason this is fascinating to me is because if you look at Great Britain and the Royal Navy, it has a real public relations problem to the point that the members of Parliament and senior officials over there say, can we combine all our services into one big service? Why do we have to have three? Do we really need to build these two new aircraft carriers? What does the Royal Navy do? We don't understand. But Americans, and in our political consciousness in the United States, we just assume that all of our services, including the Navy, will always be there, they'll always be competent, and they'll always take whatever task we need them to take. And to the services' credit, it's because they have a long history of being able to do exactly that. Americans don't think about defense, and they don't think about the military because our guys are so good, our men and women, I should say, are so good at it that you can kind of take your mind off things if you want to, because you can be assured that the Navy will be there, the Air Force will be there, and all the rest of it. The flip side of that coin is, you know, if you need the glare of the public to be able to expose things that are not going so well. For example, if we have a national commitment to defend Europe from ballistic missiles starting next year, and the Aegis systems on our cruisers and destroyers might not be working that much anymore because of parts or bureaucracy or money problems or whatever, it would be useful to have, you know, that national discussion and have that talk at a high level and be able to say, maybe we don't want to do a BMD mission for Europe next year, or maybe we do want to do it, and here's what it's going to take to get it done. So it is a real dichotomy. I think the fleet could do a better job reaching out to national newspapers, national TV shows, and getting a little bit more into depth than it does. When the Navy interacts with kind of big national media today, it's because the Modern Marvels is doing a show about aircraft carriers, or Heavy Metal is doing a show about aircraft carriers. And so their willingness to reach out has not been as much as the issues and the policies and the full spectrum of what the Navy does as much as the hardware, which is still cool. I mean, we all enjoy watching those TV shows. It just doesn't necessarily do the service that good when it has major issues that it needs to resolve.
Phil, when you look back since January, is there a particular story or piece of information that came out that you would think was the most undertold or underappreciated story in the Navy sphere?
That's a good question. I think the most underappreciated story has probably been the Aegis story, and I hesitate to say that because I'm not trying to go on a big ego trip here or trying to very cynically drive people to the Navy Times website. But at the same time, as I mentioned a second ago, we are talking about a lot of geopolitical implications with Europe and Russia here. The Obama administration decided to go with the surface Navy as the ballistic missile defense shield for Europe starting next year in place of the program that had been put in place by its predecessor. In doing so, it broke a lot of China in Eastern Europe. It made Poland and Ukraine and other countries in Eastern Europe, which are our allies, very upset because it meant pulling back a lot of the radars and American missile interceptors and other hardware that the Bush administration had promised to go out there. And so if the Navy is in a situation where its ships might not be ready for pure material readiness reasons to take that mission, you know, I kind of think that's a big deal. And you don't want to have an international treaty or international agreement imperiled because of potential readiness problems with the ships that are actually going to be out there doing this BMD mission in Europe. Fortunately or unfortunately for the Navy, it's kind of a hard read. You know, it's a very technical story about, you know, vacuum tubes and parts of bureaucracies and everything else. And so it's kind of a difficult thing to put under the head of a pin. But I do think that's the most, that's my personal view of what the most important story has been, only because Aegis is so important and ballistic missile defense is going to be so important for the Navy for the next 40 or 50 years or longer.
Eagle One.
Yeah, Phil, I'm really surprised you didn't go with the Navy blimp, the MZ-3 Alpha, as the most important undertold story.
Well, that thing was pretty neat, and it was on CNN a lot, so it wasn't undertold. That's the nice thing for the Navy. They got plenty of exposure out of that thing.
Thanks, Eagle One. Now we're going to have Campbell call the show.
Where is Campbell?
He's waiting for us to mention Blimp. That's a little inside baseball for the listeners. I'm a big fan of Airship for a variety of reasons, and every time that I post, or I think anybody else posts on Airships or Blimps, a guy, Campbell, who's involved in the industry, you can almost set your watch. He's going to be up there mentioning about it. Eagle One, did you have another follow-on question?
Well, I was curious about what more fun we can expect from the Naval Academy as the summer continues and we get into the fall semester.
Now, that is someplace unlike the surface Navy or the rest of the Navy that I'm not sure any other shoes are going to drop, because they have had so much stuff take place there over the past 6 weeks or several months that it kind of makes your head spin when you sit down and try to count it all out on your fingers. Admiral Miller, who is the incoming superintendent, is going to change command with the outgoing superintendent, Vice Admiral Fowler, in just a couple of weeks here. I think it's in early August. And that was a decision that was put into place by Admiral Ruffhead himself, the Chief of Naval Operations, who basically said, yeah, I think Admiral Fowler has had enough time in command, and we need to bring the new guy in to start the transition up there. I think that Admiral Miller is going to try to keep things as quiet as possible, and I think that he is going to try to either rebuild confidence or build confidence in himself because he's new as a part of this process coming forward. But I would be very surprised if there are very many more high-profile stories from Annapolis other than the football team in the next couple of months.
Yeah, speaking of which, when you look at Annapolis, you had Vice Admiral Rimp and then you had Fowler both leading under clouds, clouds really of their own creation. If you could sit down, which the next soup over a Coca-Cola or something, and he was nice enough to say, okay, you're in the media, what should I not focus on, or what should I not do over the next year so I can concentrate on trying to get the academy and my leadership on a firm setting?
Well, if I were having this Coca-Cola with him as a reporter, what I would say to him or what I would ask him is, you know, how can you assure your immediate constituency in Annapolis and the many alumni and many other people who are friends of the Naval Academy out there that your and the Academy's priorities continue to be in the right place? And he might say, they are, and I'm going to continue what my predecessor have been doing. Or he may say, here's the new way that I want to go. But I think what keeps coming up over and over in the stories that we at Navy Times have done and other reporters have done is that the Naval Academy right now is a football-oriented, diversity-oriented school that seems to take a lot of its other responsibilities at lower orders of importance. And I know the administration, outgoing and incoming, might dispute that, but that's what comes through in the reporting that you hear from sources up there, from the IG report that the Navy did that detailed all these things. And so on the one hand, there is a lot of pressure from alumni to beat Army and have a good football team, and there's a lot of pressure from big Navy to bring as many non-white midshipmen on board as they possibly can to try to get to this hypothetically diverse officer corps that the Navy wants to build several years down the line. But on the other hand, you know, they seem to be losing sight of what a lot of people would agree are their core goals at Annapolis to get those two goals. And so I'd be really curious about whether that's the way it's going to be and that's the way it's going to stay, or whether there are new directions that he wants to take the institution. And I don't know, I hope I have the opportunity to go up there and ask him that and write about it in the newspaper, but I haven't yet, so stay tuned for that, I hope.
And Phil, we have about 1 minute left. Over the next couple of months, as we move toward Labor Day, what are you working on, and what can people expect to see coming with your byline on it?
I will be continuing to focus on Admiral Curtis's goals of back to basics in the surface force. Taking a fix was the thing from last year. Back to basics was the more recent one, and now he has a series of initiatives and changes in place, and we'll be detailing how those are working or not working to kind of get the surface force back on a more even keel in the future.
Great, Phil. Thanks a lot for joining us. I'd like to thank everybody who joined us live, my co-host Eagle One of the blog Eagle Speak, and please join us again next week for another episode of Midrats, and I hope everybody has a great Navy Day.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.